Hello, podcast listeners. A few announcements before the episode. Beau Willimon, creator of the Netflix sensation House of Cards, will be joining Austin Film Festival at 2 p.m. Saturday, February 22nd at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin. Only 1 week after the season 2 premiere on Netflix, we sit down with Willimon for a deeper look into the process of creating House of Cards, delving into the world of political power struggles, and his journey through the second season of the show. For more info, go to austinfilmfestival.com or call 512-478-4795. Join Austin Film Festival, Chris Lowell, and Mohit Narang for a free live script reading of their second feature, Isolation Tribes. That's 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 4th, 2014, at the Clay Pit in Austin. Chris Lowell and Mohit Narang won the Jury Award and the Audience Award for their first feature, Beside Still Waters, at the 20th Austin Film Festival. Chris Lowell is known for his appearances in the Oscar-nominated films The Help and Up in the Air, as well as the forthcoming Veronica Mars movie, and the TV shows Private Practice, Veronica Mars, and Enlisted. This reading is free and open on a first-come RSVP basis. That's 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 4th, 2014, at the Clay Pit in Austin. Go to claypit.com or austinfilmfestival.com or call 512-478-4795 to find out more. Love the On Story podcasts? Pick up a copy of the On Story book today for advice and inspiration from today's leading filmmakers. On Story, Screenwriters and Their Craft, is a must-read for all screenwriters and film fans. Find it on Amazon or austinfilmfestival.com. And don't forget to search Austin Film Festival in the iTunes store to rate and review this program. Today on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, filmmaker Terry George.
Well, I challenge anybody to come up with more research than I did, because I spent 3 years in an Irish jail. You can't get more research about it.
Terry George made his screenwriting debut with the 1993 film In the Name of the Father, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. The film was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Adapted Screenplay. He went on to write and direct the film Some Mother's Son, starring Helen Mirren, and later earned his second Oscar nomination for the 2004 film Hotel Rwanda. Terry George also served as executive producer of the CBS series The District, and his numerous credits include the 2007 film Reservation Road and the Oscar-winning short film The Shore. Today's podcast was recorded at the 12th Austin Film Festival in 2005 and the 14th Austin Film Festival in 2007. Terry George will be a panelist at the 21st Austin Film Festival in October 2014. We begin with a clip from the 2005 panel, Writers Who Direct.
I think for writers, when they evolve in the direction, they can give a sense of security to the key players on the set. The costume designers and the second ADs and all panic when writers are directors, because they're in fear of change, because everything they do is very perfectly orchestrated. But the thing that you have as a writer is, when stuff goes wrong, you know integrally, like a house of cards, what the script is. And if you pull out card A, the script will still stay together, whereas if you pull out B, the whole house of cards is going to fall down. You can dance on your feet and fix stuff on the floor, which with independent film and small, and presumably, I can't get a $65 million movie made, so if there's somebody, other than Jim Hart here, I don't know that anybody in the room is going to get that sort of money to make a film. So stuff is always getting changed, and that's where the writer has the power to do that and work with the actor there. And with Rwanda, I was doing it with Dawn every day, every night, because shit changed all the time on us. And that's why I would encourage writers to become directors. And find a DP that you trust. It's the crucial relationship, and a first AD who go with you on the flow, and a good editor who's telling you stuff that you missed. And then that, once you've got that security blanket around you, then tell the story that you want to tell. I mean, the fundamental of writing and directing for me is, what is this about? What's the film about? You know, In the Name of the Father was Pinocchio. You know, the good father follows the wooden boy into the belly of the beast, and even though he dies, rescues him. That's what it's about.
Wow.
I read today, what was it? Ghostbusters. It's in the brochure. Three scientists decide to open up a ghost-busting service. There you go. Once a perfect pitch. But knowing what it's about and expressing that to the actors, and then getting the rapport back with them, what they feel about a scene, so that you have an agreement with them, and when you get on the floor, then you know where it's going, and you can have a quick dialogue rather than everything falling apart. If they say to me, I have another way of doing it, I say, go ahead, you know? Then they have to trust you in the edit room, but I say, if it works, it works. You know, try it this way, try it that way, let's move on. You know, and I had one actor who wouldn't do it my way, so I just kept doing it. And that was taking a long time. So I only did one cut of their suggestion the next time. You know, one take. And that was it, move on. And that panicked them more than me trying to push it. And then it was fine after that. Unless you're dealing with the mega actors and stuff, I think actors are terrified because they're putting their career, their beliefs, their talent in your hands. They have no idea how it's going to turn out at the end of the day. They don't know what you're going to do in the edit room. They don't know if you can do this shit or not. It's a totally trusting relationship, and you've got to give that back to them.
Drafting two different scripts for a project, the difference between film and television, and an interesting and prescient observation from way back in 2005.
I'm the most ruthless one on the set with the script. I'll ditch anything in a minute if I feel it doesn't work. And you're never going to get the locations that match your vision. You know, you can scout forever. You find what's the closest proximity of that, you get on the floor, and you make that work. And often it's better for the doing of it, you know, because it forces you to think all the time. But I come from the Jim Sheridan School of Directing, which is disastrous. Jim basically invents the whole thing on the floor. I mean, you can't, and he does another thing that Shane mentioned today. When you write a script that you're going to direct, there's two scripts you have to write. You've got to write the script that you're going to sell to people, which reads good, which is like the Bill Goldman script, which reads great. And then you've got to secretly write the script you're going to direct, which takes out all that bullshit that you put into to what you wrote, you know, and keeps the essence of it. Now, Sheridan doesn't write the script that reads great. He writes the directorial thing, which is almost unreadable, you know, but it's in his head. And he gets on the floor and he just goes with it. And it's total chaos. It drives everybody insane, you know? But I found a balance between that. I think out of necessity of the budgets that I've had, that you block things out, you get there, and then you've got to be ready to improv within knowing what the scene's about. Again, is what is this about? What have I got to get out of this scene? And most important of all, and this is in David Mamet's book on directing, which is great, you've got to know the link. What's the gap in between the two scenes? How do you get from scene A to scene B? That's the crucial thing. That piece of linkage that takes you on to the next part of the story. And I think if you have those, and that's the power of the writer being the director. Feature films are written by, made by, edited by, and generally acted by dysfunctional people. We all join the circus. Everybody falls in love with everyone else. You go off for 6 months and have the time of your life, promise you'll work together forever, and you don't see people for 10 years afterwards. That's feature films. Television is made by functional people, generally by somewhat functional actors, and it's about functional family. All series television is about the functional family. The West Wing, The Practice, NYPD Blue, they're all about the functional family, even though they have dysfunctional people within them. And the reason for that is they have to last for 7 years to make a profit. So there has to be a total functionality to that. I brought chaos to the set of The District without knowing it by rewriting all the time, and Sorkin did the same. But I don't think that's a bad thing either, because it injects into the process that fundamental question, what is this about? And I tried to make The District more than being about, oh, we arrest the bad guy. You know, that it had substance to it. But if you're writing for TV, I think you have to keep that in mind somewhat, that it's got to be episodic and functional, and at the same time not appear to be that. I mean, literally, I was told not to do what they're doing at the minute on Lost and 24, which is don't write any story arcs because we want to be able to chop this up for syndication and show it in whatever variation comes along. So the very thing that attracts you of building characters up, you're actually not allowed to do. So, I mean, and I think, but you've got to think about that functionality in television. How are you going to create characters that are going to last for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years? That's the challenge. We're at the moment of total change in filmmaking. This video iPod is the shit for us, or the versions of it. Mm. Because theoretically, before the big boys get their money in it, you could create a website and have short films or films to sell on that website and be your own distributor and all the rest. People are going to do it in the next 6 months and make shitloads of money. You know who's going to do it? The pioneers of our industry, the porn industry. Right? Ah. Absolutely. They are going to be downloading porn onto iPods in 3 months' time. I guarantee you. Why are we not doing it? Is there some difference? Are they better filmmakers? Better storytellers? Why are they making billions now? Why is there more money in Silicon Valley than there is in Hollywood? Because they hit the thing. This is what people want. We've got to answer that question. So this is the time for writer-directors now, if you get your shit together.
Terry George talks Hotel Rwanda and Reservation Road.
What we, Sheridan and I, were looking for, and me and Keir Pearson in Hotel Rwanda, was a way to take an audience inside an event that they really had no comprehension of, mm-hmm. and look at it from the inside and take them through it so that hopefully by the end of the audience, you'd have a perception of it that you wouldn't find on the news or even documentary. I always look for someone who's the audience, a character. In Hotel Rwanda, it was easy because with Paul being, you know, the hotel manager and westernized and loving fine food, fine wine, loving the notion of the Western hotel and introducing it to Africa, you could at least see where he was coming from and have some identification. And then you take him inside this this event that none of us could have any comprehension of. Yeah. The kind of difficulty there was to try and explain the political breakdown of the genocide, and I, for the most part, avoided it. I started off with that voice of the radio, of Hutu radio, which kind of set the agenda of the level of hatred. And then on a few occasions, there'd be a little bit of exposition where Joaquin Phoenix's character would ask someone what was going on. But it just seemed to me that it was more the dynamic of trying to keep the elements of the genocide out, the sort of state of siege, and then having the audience understand the courage of Paul. You don't really have to look for drama in that situation. The situation itself, you can't get much more dramatic, you know? So, and Paul was an easy vehicle for the audience there.
Yeah.
As soon as I met Paul, I met him in a hotel in Belgium, and right away he's telling me, you know, this is quite good, but, you know, go here to this restaurant, and he took us out. And actually, after the film, when we did a tour of America, we should have had Paul write his, you know, his critique of American hotels, because he just deconstructed them in a minute. It would have been a bestseller, I think. But Don, when I put the two of them together, Don just took, you know, he had this thing in his hand and fixing his tie and just how he looked and how he dealt with customers. And you didn't have to emphasize it in the exposition of it. It sort of played within the drama in that initially when he arrives at the hotel, he's sort of not repulsed, but afraid of the fact that he's brought the neighbors and what are the bosses going to think and how do I maintain the four-star status of the Michelin. And I think all of that adds to the drama more and the identification by the audience than any exposition you can really bring. Yeah, and when he goes up to throw the Hutu informer worker in the hotel who's taken over the penthouse suite, you know, it's kind of out of how dare you do that and how dare you take this suite, you know, and you can, and then once that you inject into that thing where the Hutu worker basically threatens him right away, then you get the sense of what's going on. Jerry Conlon, Daniel's character, was definitely not the audience. You know, he starts off as a petty thief. He's kind of a joker and sort of an asshole. Pete Postlethwaite, the father, in a saintly way, is the audience. And the father going back to try to rescue the son. I guess we ripped off the Pinocchio story, you know, pretty much. And Sheridan and now I, we're always looking for parallels in fables or in Greek tragedy or whatever. But by the time that Giuseppe Conlon dies, Jerry has become the father and carries on the tradition. And so you get a chance to see not just the British justice system, but the evolution of that, and also inside the whole British jail system and how they felt about the Irish and so forth. So it's usually breaking down a real situation and finding out how to humanize it and how to take people inside it. And in Reservation Road, I have one of the most hateful characters you could ever imagine. A guy who drives away from a hit-and-run accident and leaves a child dying in the road. You can't get much worse than that. But the challenge is, by the end of the film, you actually empathize and sympathize with, and it's Mark Ruffalo playing it, and we deliberately cast him, because Mark just projects, you know Mark's a good guy just by seeing him in real life, by seeing him on the screen.
Yeah.
And that was one of the challenges of Reservation Road. The subtext of Reservation Road is about revenge, about demonizing the enemy and creating a monster in your head that you can kill. Mm. And it's an allegory for post 9/11 America or post 9/11 Western Europe. And then you actually see the other side of the coin, and you see this flawed human being is so far from the monster that Joaquin Phoenix's character creates. So that challenge, and to take that other character through the flaws that he's made, and he was always running away from everything in his life, so the instinct to put the foot on the gas came after a life of failure, and it's kind of crystallizing that. Yeah, it's from a book. It's from a book that a guy called John Burnham Schwartz wrote, and then he did the first draft of the script, and then I followed up. You know, and it's the story of two families, Joaquin Phoenix and Jennifer Connelly's, they're on the way back from a concert, and they stop at a gas station, and their son is killed in a hit-and-run accident. And the driver is Mark Ruffalo, who has his son in the car, and he's going through a really acrimonious divorce with his ex-wife, Mira Servino. And it's the evolution of what happens to those two families in the wake of the event. So the very nature of the event and what happens afterwards is pretty much as dramatic as you can get on a mundane and accessible way, in that it could have happened to any of us. And that's the thing about this film, that's why I say it's more accessible to an audience than any of the others, because not for a minute do you ever, you can empathize with Paul, but you don't think you're ever going to be in a genocide, and you certainly don't think you're going to be in a British prison, wrongly accused. So with this, it's always putting the audience in there, you know, would I have done this or would I not? And there, but for the grace of God, go I in the situation. And actually the challenge is not to make it maudling and you know, try not to make it overwhelmingly depressing for the audience and create some form of entertainment from it, and which I always try to start off from. Why are people going to pay $12 or $10 or whatever to sit and watch this? And with this, I mean, it's the hardest marketing challenge that folks are going to have, but I have four of the best actors in the world, and I have them in a situation where they're challenging each other. And if you do see it, there are scenes between Jennifer Connelly and Joaquin that'll just lift the hair on the back of your neck, and scenes between Mark and Joaquin that I always thought of the publicity that Heat had. You know, De Niro's going to meet Pacino. And I'm thinking, well, I've got two actors up there and I'm going to put them together in that situation and see what happens, you know. But the funny thing about this panel is everything we do is drama, really, isn't it? I always hate being asked that question, like, what genre are you in? Are you a drama or are you a thriller?
Term.
I mean, all thrillers are drama. Jesus Christ, you're looking for the swing of the turn of it.
Storytelling.
Storytelling
maybe in a form, horror film or whatever. Or so that's what all of us do so well. I mean, the fantastic thing about Reversal of the Fortune for me was that you had Klaus von Bülow was funny just by him. Anytime I ever saw him, I thought he was a character of, you know, bizarre character. Yeah. And then Jeremy, who I know is quite bizarre himself, you know.
The value and peril of research, story structure, and advice for emerging filmmakers.
Well, I challenge anybody to come up with more research than I did, because I spent 3 years in an Irish jail. You can't get more research about
Don't try this at
the
home,
films, your films and that, and obviously three movies came out of it. And the challenge with Hotel Rwanda was trying to not just universalize it, but get to a place where people could comprehend to some degree what was going on. So you're actually sandpapering down the research you do to those basic things that the audience will get, so that you at least do justice to the event without being expositional at all. And that actually takes more research than normal, because you're looking for that one thing that'll just twist it. One thing I'd just say, though, if you're doing a real event, and particularly a political event, feature films are about the distillation of that event, you know, the essence of it. And by the very nature of films, you're going to have to make composite characters and join events together. And there's this thing that journalists do. I mean, journalists basically write bad news. They don't write good news. There's no news in good news. So they are looking to deconstruct your film in a way to say it's not true. And particularly with the Irish movies that we did, the British press came after us with a hatchet as soon as we started. So you better do extra research. And with Hotel Rwanda, I was acutely aware of this. So every character and every event, I tried to relate to something that had happened and have a distillation of it, so that no one could say that I was distorting the thing or inventing or whatever, because that's surely what's going to happen. And I think you have to be really careful about that. You have to ask yourself, what's the overall event about? It's about a good man facing evil and in doing that, triumphing over evil. So that's the story. But what are the real events that build towards that? And what are the events that build toward the character? So go to the real events and find that. I'm actually in the middle of writing the most complicated, and certainly from that point of view, the most dangerous project I've ever done, which is the biography of a man called Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was the UN diplomat who was killed in Baghdad. And Sergio was basically the Bobby Kennedy of the UN, who was going to, everyone knew, would take over from Kofi Annan and might go somewhere to fixing it. But Sergio was involved in literally every war and humanitarian event from basically the time he joined the UN. So I'm going to be dealing with, like, Bush, Milosevic, you know, Saddam Hussein, Richard Holbrooke, you know, just about everybody in the story itself has a political twist and has an ego, and so it's a complete minefield. But I've written a fable about a white knight who never uses the sword, which is the basis of the film. So I'll go back to the events to try to match the events I've written in the fable, and hopefully make that work. And I have a book to work from. But that's what I mean about a distillation of what the man's life is about. The three-act structure is a bit of a cheat, because they actually say by page 12 there should be something happen. So that's a division of the first act in itself. It turns it into an act. I mean, I use it because it seemed right to me that by page 30 or whatever it is, you know, a certain point of the way in, there better be a major thing that turns the audience around in a direction. And you do need a start to the conclusion, a start to the finale. But there's a lot of stuff in that second act that breaks it down into different acts. For me, the greatest invention in script writing is the post-it. And the multicolored one. Not seriously, the multicolors, because it becomes a visual thing for me. I get a board, I have a single word for what a scene's about, not even actually the description of the scene, but something that sums it up, and a color for the character that's involved. And I put it up on a wall or a board, and I stand back. Then I can see the flow of the character, the flow of the events itself, and sort of, you know, and if I have five blue post-its in a row, I know something's wrong there in the interrelationship of the A and B drama and so forth. And I did always read all those books, Linda Seeger and a little bit Sid Field, who I didn't, you know, he was too pompous for me or something. But I read them because it stimulated a thought in my head about those very things, about structure. It's hard. Well, I guess for the first-time writer, it's just cracking it. You know, how do you crack that thing? Don't send it to CAA or ICM. You know, they won't even recycle the paper. That challenge, and for me, it was working in theater and working with people, working with drama on the stage, and working with actors and finding a way to. See how your story works, and then hopefully that working in theater for me, I met Sheridan there, and basically off we went, the two of us, through that connection. But I think now, this moment in time, is the gold rush for writers, and there's this form out there that is beyond the studios, beyond everyone, and that's the internet and YouTube, and of course they've bought it already. You know, Murdoch's bought MySpace and somebody else has bought YouTube, but at the minute it's anarchic enough that you could take your script, find someone, you know, and find some actors and do something with it and get it on YouTube. And the agencies now, they have four or five junior agents combing those websites, those viral websites, to find talent. You know, I don't know if any of you have seen the Battle of Kruger, the safari film that the amateur group going through Kruger Park filmed, which is the most amazing safari wildlife thing you will ever see in your life. Just go on to YouTube, put in Kruger Park, click it, and at the end, the guy who is filming says, I wonder could we sell this, you know? 21 million hits later. If he'd have charged 10 cents a view for that, he'd have had $2.1 million now. And Will Farrell and his little niece or nephew, or the friend's nephew. So there's an audience and a way out there now to actually get your work out to an audience that bypasses all of these traps. So that's my advice for everybody now, including myself, but I just don't have the time to get to it. Film a joke. If you hear a great joke or can write a great joke yourself, make a film out of it and get it out. The chances, the possibility, and it's gone soon. It's like Fidel Castro's Cuba. They're going to buy the whole thing up, and they're going to lobotomize it and make it a money-making machine, and it'll be gone.
Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival, the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission of the Arts, and is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com.